this bolt of lightning shot across the universe and inspired me with the idea that we have to do a podcast. And that's what I wanted to tell you. We should do a podcast. Okay, bye.
I hit record.
I hit record.
We're doing it. We're doing it. It's happening right now.
Welcome to Feature Creep, colon, built-in microwave.
Semicolon.
Whatever. I don't know. Another
flourish my ass.
Flourish my ass. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Flourish my ass.
Here's something to be outraged over that's not probably what's weighing on your heart right now.
Yeah. This. Okay. So today is November 8th.
Yep.
November 5th was my birthday, and once again, happy, it was a day that I mostly don't care about in terms of it being my birthday and being special. I'm 45 sure. now. I don't, like, it doesn't need to be celebrated.
Yeah.
It's a day that I otherwise wouldn't care about, except for the fact that every 4 years it gets ruined.
Right.
Because elections. Yeah. And because nobody in this country is anywhere near advocating politically for things that I think are important, it's right. always a disappointment because nobody's having the conversation I want to have ever.
Right.
So I was pretty upset about the elections and how they went, not even because of who won, but just because of who the options even were and how sure. they arrived at being the option. So we won't even get into that because something even more pressing and irritating arose in my life. And I did, like, we early voted, and so Tuesday wasn't like a day that we did anything special. I went to this job I got, and I came home, and I started reading a book for school, and this book pisses me off even more than politics, which is an awful, awful lot. And I will tell you why. It's called Flourish, and it was written by a man named Martin E. P. Seligman, who is a psychologist by trade, by profession. He's a professional psychologist. His deal is like 10 years or so prior to writing this book, Flourish, that he wrote another book called Authentic Happiness. And he decided at the time that he wrote Authentic Happiness that he was going to tell everybody how to achieve authentic happiness. It doesn't matter who you are. You just have to do what this white man tells you. And all of a sudden, all your troubles are going to go away. Right.
Ooh, so actually, the title of this podcast is going to be Follow the Simple Sophistry. Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry. Follow the Simple Sophistry for a Perfect Life. Listen to the end to find out the answer. The secret.
Perfect.
The
yes.
secret.
The
I
secret.
Promise we're going to tell at the end. And just in case you're actually paying attention, that there's no secret.
Like there's no
secret. You can stop now or you can listen for the joy of listening, but
right.
Yeah. There's not, yeah. So skip to the end. There'll be something completely irrelevant that we're going to talk uh-huh. about.
Yes.
Anyway, yes. sorry, go on. So
no, it's fine. So the preface of the book, this started out the experience of reading this book.
Oh God.
So. Has started out immediately right off the bat yes. reminded me of reading Sapiens.
Yes, which we attempted to read together, and I think I made it through chapter one.
I made it through the introduction and chapter one and started on chapter two before I had to put it down forever.
Right. Yeah. And we had Sapiens. Anyway, so that was Sapiens. So
yes, Sapiens
on.
Was terrible. This book, yeah. Flourish, is also terrible for many of the same reasons.
Right.
That Sapiens is horrible and terrible and a total piece of garbage that you should never waste your time on.
Right.
So Seligman writes this book, Authentic Happiness, like ages ago, like 20 years ago or something like that.
Yep.
And tells everybody in that book, here, everything else is bullshit. My ideas are in a zero-sum game with everybody else's ideas. I have the unifying theory on what happiness is and how to achieve it. I'm a psychologist. This is the way to do it. This is how you encourage and cultivate happiness in your life. And if you don't do it this way, you're going to fail because everything else previous to my telling you this has failed. And so you got to do what I tell you to do. Otherwise, you're never going to be happy. And then he writes this book, Flourish,
right?
Like 10 years later. And he's like, just kidding. Everything I said in that book was wrong. The point of your life should not be striving for happiness. It should be striving for flourishing. And he takes great pains to muddy the waters on what he even means by flourishing.
Yes.
And he rips off the concept from 2,000 or more years of philosophy, flattens it into a 5-point list. Yes. And then basically says you got to check off all these things on the list to achieve flourishing or you're never going to be happy. And happiness isn't even really the point. Flourishing is. And all those things I told you before that I insisted you listen to because it had science behind it, I'm telling you was wrong. But this time you should believe me because this time I have science.
Right.
Not like that other time I told you I had science. Right. And it turned out I was wrong about everything.
Yes.
So like I read very quickly. I can get through a book in a day. It's not hard. Yeah. Hundreds and hundreds of pages just fly by, right? I have spent more than 2 days reading this book and I am only on page 40 fucking four because it's so arduous and terrible to read. I can't make it through quickly. One, because most of what he says doesn't make any fucking sense. And at first I made the mistake of trying to understand what he was saying. And there is no understanding it because it is gibberish.
Right.
Not only is it gibberish, it is unsupported gibberish. He doesn't tell you why he thinks the things that he thinks.
Yeah. Also, just to punctuate your 5-point list, to precede the 5-point list is a 3-point list to let you know about things that can or cannot be counted as an element of well-being.
Yes. So he has this insane, like, sort of structural flowcharty thing about, like, what counts for an element of flourishing and for one of the five elements of flourishing to be present, each of those things has to have a very specific case of a subset of things that contribute to the thing that contributes to flourishing. It's just like such hogwash. Anyway,
so can we talk about it for a second?
Yes, or is
it,
let's okay. do it.
So,
yes.
So on the Wikipedia webpage for Martin Seligman.
Yes, that is him.
There's a section called well-being, and I'm going to just skip through it real quick so people can kind of follow along.
Yes.
So in his book, Flourish, published in 2011, he wrote with respect to how he measures well-being. Each element of well-being must itself have three properties to count as an element. Here we go. Number one, it contributes to well-being. Okay, great. Is that a talk? No, we'll talk about that in a second. Let me get through this. I have so many ideas. Okay.
Yes.
Number two, many people pursue it for its own sake, not merely to get any of the other elements. Okay, check. Number three, it is defined and measured independently of the other elements. Okay. So now let's get to the second part.
You're like, okay, with you so far, great.
Gotcha. All right. Right. Sure. I'll grant you these ideas. Great. Okay. Seligman concluded that there are five elements to well-being which fall under the mnemonic PERMA, P-E-R-M-A. P for positive emotion, can only be assessed subjectively. E for engagement, like positive emotion, can only be measured through subjective means. It is presence of a flow state. R, relationships, the presence of friends, family, intimacy, or social connection. M, meaning, belonging to and serving something bigger than oneself. A, achievement, accomplishment that is pursued even when it brings no positive emotion, no meaning, and nothing in the way of positive relationships. Okay, also Wikipedia says, these theories have not been empirically validated. Anyway, but science. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So with that in mind and looking through these, I would propose that there's actually a sixth element that goes on the end. Also M, masturbation. Tell me if I'm wrong. Okay. So first, to be an element, it must contribute to well-being. I would argue that's true.
Sure.
Two, many people pursue it for its own sake, not merely to get any of the other elements. I would argue that that's true.
Yep.
Three, it is defined and measured independently of the other elements. So what? Like, okay, so if I were to measure masturbation, like that I do it?
Yeah.
Like, let's say, okay, so this week, just arbitrary number, five times. Great.
Sure.
So I did five. I'm going to say
you
did five. Okay, good job. Go team. So does that count or not? Like, is it you know, I can hear, I can imagine reading this. He's like, oh, but what about positive emotion? I'm like, I don't know. That's not, there is no other way for me to have the feelings that I have for masturbation than masturbation itself.
Right. And he specifically mentions in the book, I'm trying to find it here. He specifically says that this example particularly is only an element of happiness and not an element of well-being.
The example of masturbation?
Yes. He specifically calls it out.
So it's an element of happiness, but not well-being. So,
right.
Gosh,
I'm trying to find it in the text here.
Okay.
Because I found that that was really weird, and I found it weird that he specifically called it out as not being an element of well-being.
It's like he already met me and had a conversation with me, and he's like, "Fuck right. that guy! I'm gonna write in my book that that's wrong."
Well, I mean, this is probably why he's right. He doesn't even know you, and he anticipated what you were gonna say. He says, this is funny. When I wrote Authentic Happiness a decade ago, this is me quoting the book. Yeah. I wanted to call it Positive Psychology, but the publisher thought that happiness in the title would sell more books. I've been able to win many skirmishes with editors, but never over titles. And so he says that happiness underexplains what it is you should be looking for in life. Like, happiness is too simple. Because you can get happiness by just, like, jerking off. So that can't be it. That's the example that he gives, right? It's just too easy. It's too superficial.
It's too easy.
Right.
You don't have to worry. I don't know about you, but as I get older, it's not just too easy. It's fucking production.
Right. And his whole deal with anyway, like the sorry. Authentic happiness, his yes. problem with his previous theory of authentic happiness is that it too was too simple. He said authentic happiness, the theory in authentic happiness is that happiness could be analyzed into three different elements, not five. He left two of them out, right?
Right.
Positive emotion, engagement, and meaning. And each of these elements is better defined and more measurable than happiness. The first, positive emotion, is what we feel. Pleasure, rapture, ecstasy, warmth, comfort, the like. An entire life led successfully around this element I call the pleasant life. Which he puts into quotes as if like he invented that. The second element, engagement, is about flow. The loss of self-consciousness during an absorbing activity, right? He said, in flow, we merge with the object. I believe that the concentrated attention that flow requires uses up all the cognitive and emotional resources that make up thought and feeling. But he never says why he thinks that. Like, he just throws that out there.
This is very... This is absolutely like Sapiens. It's that speaking with authority and using an authoritative tone about shit that you're just, there's no, like, none of
it's
these
just
are
your opinions,
you
man.
Can't substantiate any of this.
Right. Right. It's unsubstantiatable.
It's just like, I mean, this is like, yeah.
So yeah. He talks about why he switched from authentic happiness theory to well-being theory, and he hyphenates well-being, by the way, which I find annoying for some reason.
Yeah.
So he says the theory of well-being is very different from authentic happiness theory, and the difference requires explanation. And he offers a little table, right? In the left column, authentic happiness theory. In the right column, well-being theory. In the left column, topic, happiness. In the right column, topic, well-being, but doesn't describe what the difference between the two of them is, right?
Yeah. You know what makes me nuts about all of this is the obvious commodification grab.
Uh-huh.
Like,
that's a huge critique of this book, is that it's all just a capitalist scam.
Like, the problem isn't that, like, when you look at the well-being entry for on Wikipedia, you start to get it, like, the article itself talks about the different people who've written about well-being and happiness. Ah. And it's like, this is absolutely contribute to it. Fucking write a whole bunch of garbage and say shit and then change your mind. Like, yeah. That is not only allowed, but encouraged. Like, that's right. The whole point of working on things like this. And, like, worthy pursuit. Absolutely. You want to spend your, like, your whole life philosophizing about how to be happy. Fantastic. Like, that is not my criticism here. Like,
right.
I think you're wrong what you've written already. Mm-hmm. But I don't, like, my problem is that fucking authoritative shit where it's like paternal, like, oh, yeah, if you just do this, you'd be happy.
If and you that, were just like more like me. Shit.
Yeah, if you just mm-hmm. look like more like me, like, yeah, it'd be fucking
yeah,
great.
Yeah, all throughout the book, well, all throughout the first 44 pages, which yeah. I've slogged through unhappily, speaking of flourishing and happiness, this book is preventing that from my life. So, like, he talks about, like how measuring in authentic happiness theory, the measure of how happy you are is a measure of life satisfaction, which he does not define. But contrast that with his well-being theory, which is measured by positive emotion, engagement, meaning, positive relationships, and accomplishment. How is that not life satisfaction?
Right.
Like, you're not, there's no differentiation here to me. It's not clear to me what the differentiation is. He also says, like, the goal of his old authentic happiness theory was to increase life satisfaction. And the goal of his new well-being theory is to increase flourishing by increasing positive emotion, engagement, meaning, positive relationships, and accomplishment. So he basically says well-being theory is about well-being, and you measure it through positive emotion, engagement, meaning, and positive relationships. And the goal is to increase positive emotion, engagement, meaning, and positive relationships. It's just, like, so repetitive. Like, it's just like... What you can tell because of the way it is.
You can tell because of the way it is, though.
You can tell because of the way it is.
You know how I know well-being theory is about well-being? Because it says so.
Because it says so right there in the title, well-being theory. Right. So he says...
we're making a lot of insights.
Yeah, so we could write a book. He says...
we have written a book.
He says there are three inadequacies with his previous authentic happiness theory. The yeah. first is that the dominant popular connotation of happiness is inextricably bound up with being in a cheerful mood. So the mood you're in determines more than 70% of how much life satisfaction you report. 70%? Where does that number come from?
Right.
Like,
this
what?
Is a good how? Question.
That's a quantitative thing. So where's what are you counting?
I mean, personally, I've always felt like it was 71%, so I know, really right? disagree here.
See, I always thought it was 69, but that was for other reasons.
Well, this is one of the reasons we don't get along very well.
Right. He says, how much life satisfaction you report and how well you judge your life to be going at any moment determines less than 30%. Of like your life satisfaction. So he says the old gold standard of positive psychology is disproportionately tied to mood. And he talks about this like it's a critique, and it's like, well, you're the one who invented it, dipshit.
Right.
You're just arguing with yourself now.
Yes.
Like, what are you even talking about? So he says, well-being theory is superior because well-being theory denies that the topic of positive psychology is a real thing. Rather, the topic is a construct, the construct of well-being, which in turn has several measurable elements, each a real thing, each contributing to well-being, but none defining well-being. So he has this weird obsession with like real and not real, but he never gets to the bottom of what that means or what he means by that.
So everything, I would say that everything that this person writes, every passage that you've shared with me in our chat and everything, smacks of someone who completely rejects scientific method and the scientific community. Like,
right. Well, yes.
And the reason I say this is because it's like, it's kind of the way fucking Sapiens was written, right? Where it's like, yeah. Completely rejected by like respectable fucking people who know the topic, right? The
right.
people who have, you know, spent their careers and half their lives studying and working on and developing the research methods that are used to understand the shit. And then
yep.
and the reason that fucking Harari has never published a paper in that community is because it would never get published. So
right.
instead you publish a book where encouragingly, yes, anyone can publish a book. Fantastic. We've done
right.
it. You
yep.
know, absolutely, let's not fucking, you know, beat around the bush. Like, that's a good thing that books can be published. But,
yeah.
But garbage. Like, not
yeah.
good thought, not well-researched, poorly supported. And that's kind of the same problem, is it's like everything about this guy, the way he writes, strikes me as someone who was rejected by any kind of scientific rigor. A big part of it is like having peers say, ah, your idea, that's interesting, let me repeat it. Oh, that's full of shit, I had these problems. Or just on the face of it being like, that fucking shit is bullshit, prove it.
Right. Right.
Of which he's done none other than write a book.
He says, I have spent my professional life avoiding unguarded promises like this one. This book will help you flourish. There, I have finally said it. I am a research scientist. No, you are not. No, you are not, sir.
No, you are not.
You are a psychologist, which is not the same thing. And a conservative one at that, he says. The appeal of what I write comes from the fact that it is grounded in careful science.
But he doesn't provide any of it.
Nope, he does not. He does not provide any of the supposed careful science that he did that led him to any of the conclusions that he presents in this book without support. So, like, he says, my writings are believable because of the underlying science, which he fails to demonstrate or share in any way. The thing that really pissed me off about this book, so far more than anything else, is that I discovered after launching into it and reading from the start and working my way through it that he has a massive appendix and a notes section at the back of the book. But the notes are numbered in the notes section, but these numbers are not indicated in the body of the text. So in other words, when you're reading the book itself, you have no idea if what you are reading at any given time has a footnote or an endnote attached to it. Because it's not denoted in the text by a superscript or a subscript or anything like that. There's no footnote on the page.
Yeah.
So you have no idea if there's additional information that supports what you're reading. You basically have to go through the notes section as its own thing and then flip back to the text based on where in the notes section it says that he's referring to something in the text, but it's not denoted in the text. So it's like, that's not even how you do end notes. Like, he just invented a new way of doing end notes that like nobody else does. So like, he says that like, he spent most of his life working on psychology's venerable goal of relieving misery and uprooting the disabling conditions in life. And he goes on to say, and I'm paraphrasing here, all of psychology up to him has gotten it wrong because they focused on the alleviation of misery as opposed to the propagation of flourishing instead.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, paying attention to like misery and trying to alleviate misery is a lost cause. It's fucking pointless. You got to focus on the positive. And that's why he invented what he calls positive psychology.
So this is
so he's not interested in root cause analysis or anything like that at all.
So reality distortion is his his prescription.
Yeah, he says his new goal is exploring what makes life worth living and building the enabling conditions of a life worth living. I ask you, if your goal is to build the enabling conditions, would you not inherently eliminate the disabling conditions as well?
Yeah, this is
so he presents himself in this like mutually exclusive way where it's all his idea and his idea stands in diametric and like unavoidable contrast to everything else that everybody's ever done in terms of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And like also that he doesn't really give any credit to like the 2000 years of philosophy that's been written about flourishing and maximizing the good and ethics and all that stuff, which is all about what he's talking about. But he just kind of like steals a couple of ideas from Aristotle and like sort of is like, Aristotle kind of said this one time, and then like passes it off as his own. But it's like super reductive. Like, he took all of philosophical ethics and all of psychology and flattened the human experience of misery and flourishing into a 5-point list.
Yeah.
It's just like super reductive, right? Go ahead. Like,
also, it's just sort of, it smacks of like whitewashing the fucking misery and suffering that is the human condition.
Yes. Like, so that is another critique that has been launched at this book, that it basically whitewashes
Because, like, you look at
all the nuance out of it.
You look at, like, these other, like, you look at, like, Buddhism or something, which I am admittedly not an expert in. But
yeah, me either. I don't know.
My exposure to Buddhism suggests that it is not interested in dismissing your experience.
Yeah.
Or asking you to stop, to not have that experience, but have this other one. It mm-hmm. talks about how to. I don't need to get into it. My point is, like, I think there's some distinction there, and like, maybe not. Anyway, sorry, go on. You're yeah.
No, I got you. The thing that jumped out at me, and why I personally don't have any positive regard for anything that he says in this book, doesn't actually have anything to do with his theory per se. It has to do with his methodologies and his orientation to the problem that he is identifying. And I'll read you the section here that really got my hackles up. And it's only on page 6. So this is at the very front end of the book. I'm still in the preface here, right?
Yeah.
He says, where is it? So he was working... In 1997, he got a mysterious email, and all that the email said.
Sorry.
I know, right? It's so ridiculous. Try this one weird trick.
Go on. Yes,
I get this email in late 1997, and I put it into my folder, and it simply said, "Why don't you come up to see me in New York?" and was signed with initials only, right? So he's like, who the hell is this? And he doesn't think about it much. And then he talks to a woman named Judy, who headed the MacArthur Foundation's massive project on psychoneuroimmunology, which is the study of the pathways through which psychological events influence neural events, which in turn influence immune events, which in and of itself sounds kind of interesting. So he says to this woman, Judy, do you know a PT who might have sent me an email inviting me to New York? And she goes, oh my God, go see him. Like, this is what it says in the text, right?
Right.
So 2 weeks later, he says, I found myself at an unmarked door on the 8th floor of a small, grimy office building in the bowels of Lower Manhattan, where I was ushered into an undecorated windowless room in which sat 2 gray-haired, gray-suited men and 1 speakerphone. Like, this sounds like I Heart Huckabees.
Right?
This sounds like a fucking movie, right?
Yes.
So he says, quote, we are the lawyers for an anonymous foundation, explained one of them, introducing himself as PT, the person who sent the email allegedly, right?
Yep.
Quote, we pick winners and you are a winner. We'd like to know what research and scholarship you want to do. We don't micromanage. We should warn you at the outset, however, that if you reveal our identity, any funding we give you will stop. I briefly explained to the lawyers, this is Seligman talking again, and the speakerphone, one of my APA initiatives, ethnopolitical warfare, most assuredly not any kind of positive psychology, and said that I would like to hold a meeting of the 40 leading people who work in genocide. I wanted to find out when genocides do or do not occur by comparing settings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I would edit a book, la, la, la. Thanks for telling us, they said after 5 minutes. And when you get back to your office, would you send us a one pager about this and don't forget to include a budget, right? So... uncritically,
yeah,
this man says, 2 weeks later, a check for over $120,000 appeared on my desk. A delightful shock, since almost all the academic research I had known is funded through tedious grant requests, annoying peer reviews, office bureaucracy, unconscionable delays, wrenching revisions, and then rejection or at best heart-stopping budget cuts. So in other words, like a process of fucking academic rigor, you charlatan.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So he says, I held the week-long meeting about the, you know, genocide or whatever, and then published a book called Ethnopolitical Warfare, and it was published in 2002. I had almost forgotten this generous foundation, the name of which I still did not know, when I got a call from the treasurer about 6 months later. In the margin here, I wrote, what the fucking fuck?
Yeah.
This was a super meeting you held in Derry, Marty. I met 2 brilliant people there, the medical anthropologist Mel Connor and that McCarthy chap. What does he do, by the way? And what do you want to do next? Next, I stammered, wholly unprepared to solicit more funding. Well, I'm thinking about something I call positive psychology. Why don't you come visit us in New York? They said. The morning of the next visit, Mandy, my wife, offered me my best white shirt, blah, 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 blah. What is this positive psychology? These mysterious men asked me. After about 10 minutes of explanation, they ushered me out and said, when you get back to your office, would you send us a 3-pager and don't forget to include a budget? A month later, a check for $1.5 million appeared. This is so fucking unethical.
It's so fucking unethical.
This is so incredibly radically unethical.
It's just like, okay.
So he's just taking mystery money from people to perform research that circumvents all of the like guardrails that are in place for qualified academic research.
This is the shit that people are constantly worried about research in the first place, is that money is fucking perversing it, right?
Right, right.
Like, it's constantly an accusation, constantly a problem. It is a problem of the academic community that is attempted to be addressed through like ethical like considerations and ethical review boards and all of the, like, I'm not saying any of it works.
In other words,
like,
tedious grant requests, annoying peer reviews, officious bureaucracy, unconscionable delays, wrenching revisions.
Wait, does he say annoying peer reviews?
Yes.
His words. That's my fucking point. Everything he writes, like, reads like someone who's like, I fucking hate peer reviews and I dare you to say anything about this shit. I'm speaking with authority. I fucking know. You should sit down and shut the fuck up. I put it in a book now. None of you get to fucking tell me otherwise.
Right. And so all of this shit, like these weird, mysterious people that sought him out of nowhere, they got to him early in his career when he was a nobody. Right. Like, they found him and they were like, hey, guy, why don't you just take our money and do whatever you feel like? And he was like, that seems legit. Now I'm just going to manufacture my own authority on the subject, even though I've circumvented all the other authoritative, like all of the other things that supposedly undergird authority, academic authority. Right. And we can have a whole conversation about whether academia is actually authoritative or not. Right. Yep. But like, that's another conversation. Right. So he get the second round. He gets $1.5 million fucking dollars from these mysterious people who he still doesn't know who they are or where the money's coming from.
Right.
OK. So then he does the shit. They contact him again. And he says, this time I wore my best white shirt and there was a sign on the door that read Atlantic Philanthropies. The foundation, it turns out, was the gift of a single generous individual, Charles Feeney, who had made his fortune in duty-free shops and donated it all, $5 billion, to these trustees to do good work. And I underlined good work and I was like, what the fuck does that mean?
Right.
Good work? How do you validate it as good when you refuse any consideration by other people in your field as to whether or not it's rigorous, ethical, like contradicts what other people have said, supports what other people have said, just re-says what other people have said. Like, you don't know any of that because you refuse to engage with the normal process. So he says, this time they had a directive. We'd like to gather the leading scientists and scholars and answer the Mandela Milosevic question from the genetics all the way up to the political science and sociology of good and evil. And we intend to give you $20 million to study what we would like you to study this time. Right? So they basically reel this dumb fucker in with like trickles of money that are inconsequential amounts of money in the face of a $5 billion endowment, right? And they basically get this guy on their side and then they start dictating where his research is going to go.
Okay.
Right? So they're like, we'll give you $20 million to do what we say. And he's like, why not?
Seems totally legit, right?
Sounds fine. So he says, this was a lot of money, certainly way above my pay grade. And so I bit hard. Like, he acknowledges that he doesn't really deserve this kind of funding, but he's going to take it anyway.
Right.
Right. So he is essentially motivated by a profit motive, which is one of the critiques of this book.
Right.
It's like, you're not really in this for the research, or you wouldn't be so averse to peer review and actually contributing to a body of knowledge.
Right.
What you're interested is the giant sums of money they're throwing at you, no strings attached, as long as you do what they say.
Right. Exactly.
So, like, he says, he said, I wrote in this margin, who the fuck are you bedfellows with? And so he said, I began a radical rethinking of what positivity and flourishing are. And so he has this little like inset that's really reductive. Thales thought that everything was water. Aristotle thought that all human action was to achieve happiness. Nietzsche thought that all human action was to get power. And Freud thought that all human action was to avoid anxiety. Now you know everything about 2,500 years of philosophy. You don't have to think about it any deeper. Just listen to Martin Seligman. He'll sum it up for you. Right. Sorry. You don't have to think about it. Just trust him. You know, like he trusts those people throwing $22 million at him.
Right.
So like he says in here, where is it? He says, freedom is a construct, not a real thing. Well-being is just like weather and freedom in its structure. No single measure defines it exhaustively. In jargon, defines exhaustively is called operationalizes. But several things contribute to it. These are the elements of well-being, and each of the elements is a measurable thing. What the fuck does any of that mean? It's not confusing, like, because it's too smart. No. It's confusing because it's incoherent, right? So the construct of well-being, not the entity of life satisfaction, is the focal topic of positive psychology. Enumerating the elements of well-being is our next task. I mean, you're with him so far, right? It's all making sense. So he says, authentic happiness theory comes dangerously close to Aristotle's monism because happiness is operationalized or defined by life satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
What? Well-being has several contributing elements that take us safely away from monism. It is so he's basically like, me and Aristotle are saying the same thing here, but mine is better and different because it's not monism. And here's why. It is essentially a theory of uncoerced choice, and its five elements comprise what free people will choose for their own sake. And each element of well-being must itself have three properties to count as an element. Like, it's this weird, like, pigeonholing shit. Like, okay, you guys, turns out the truth fits into a 5-bullet point list, and each of those 5 bullet points have three, no more than three, no less, three, exactly three contributing things that make the 5 things, right? It's just like, and he never goes into, like, like I said, with the notes and the footnotes and the endnotes and the appendix and stuff, he doesn't explain or offer data or like clinical trial results or anything about any of this. He talks about meaning. This part I find really funny, right? This part actually made me laugh out loud.
Yeah.
Meaning is not solely a subjective state. The dispassionate and more objective judgment of history, logic, and coherence can conduct contradict a subjective judgment. Abraham Lincoln, a profound melancholic, may have in his despair judged his life to be meaningless, but we judge it pregnant with meaning. How do you know that Abraham Lincoln thought his own life was meaningless? Like, that's a weird thing to say, right? Like, that just seems like random. He says, Jean-Paul Sartre, and this is the part that made me laugh, his existentialist play, No Exit, might have been judged meaningful by him and his post-World War II devotees, but now it seems wrong-headed. Hell is other people. And almost meaningless, since today it is accepted without dissent, that connections to other people and relationships are what give meaning and purpose to life. Nobody's dissenting. Nobody's going to argue with Martin Seligman that today what is really important and accepted without dissent is that connections to other people and relationships are what give life and purpose, life, purpose, and meaning, right?
Yeah.
Like, just these weird statements like, no, there is no accepted without dissent. The reason you think that is because you have rejected any of the avenues through which you might accumulate dissent to your theory. Like, up front, you've just precluded them from, like, being meaningful to you. I just love that Jean-Paul Sartre, he, like, is like, Sartre was wrong because everybody agrees what really matters is relationships.
God.
And I'm like, no, Sartre was right. Hell is other people, and you're doing it to me right now. You know, he talks about like he talks about, where is it here? He says, meaning meets three criteria of elementhood. It contributes to well-being. It's often pursued for its own sake. For example, your single-minded advocacy for AIDS research annoys others, makes you miserable subjectively, and has gotten you fired from your writing job, but you persist undaunted. What? Like, I love how he shits all over AIDS advocacy.
Yes.
Like, what's your problem with people advocating for, like, AIDS research and shit? Like, he just says these things out of nowhere, and you're like, what's your beef with fucking advocates for what? He also says, this is what I find undermined any hanging thread of credibility that I thought this man had. Yes. Is completely eradicated on page 19, where he says, winning for winning's sake can also be seen in the pursuit of wealth. Some tycoons pursue wealth and then give much of it away in astonishing gestures of philanthropy. John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie set the model, and Charles Feeney, i.e. the person who gave him all his fucking money, no yep. strings attached, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are, this is a direct quote, contemporary paragons of virtue.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Holy shit, my dude.
I wonder if they'll give him $20 million because he wrote something nice about them.
Holy fucking shit. Paragons
yes.
of virtue?
I know. Just...
He says, Rockefeller and Carnegie spent the second half of their lives giving away to science and medicine, to culture and education, much of the fortunes they had made in the first half of their lives. They created meaning later in their lives after their early lives of winning only for winning's sake. So first of all, I don't know that you can like righteously categorize what Rockefeller and Carnegie did as motivated right. solely for the purpose of winning for winning's sake.
Also, I feel like winning for winning's sake completely ignores the fucking psychology of it.
Right.
It's
which
like,
is supposed to be his whole deal, right?
Right. Like someone who's winning for winning's sake, it's like winning means something to that person. They're motivated right. to do it. You can clearly observe it.
Right.
That person is choosing over and over again to do this thing competitively in a way that they're winning, whatever that means. I mean, right. also, or like they're driven by something. Like,
right.
you know, typically people like that are deeply unhappy in many ways. Like it's, you know, it's a well-known, like my partner talks about Harvard Business School and like all the people that she met there mm-hmm. and like all of them were like deeply broken in a way. Right. Like in her, yeah. in her mind. I mean, like, you know, this is not scientific evidence. It's just
yeah.
sort of this idea that it's like the people there who are so motivated to want to achieve at this level in this way are deeply driven towards something. Right. Like there's yes. something they're trying to fill or, you know, that's not winning for winning's sake.
No,
they're not just like, I don't know. Anyway, sorry.
He just like puts these ideas in other people's heads. Like, okay,
oh, yeah, no,
John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie are long dead. You can't ask them why they did what they did. You maybe could read like if they left letters behind, if they had collected letters, if there's like an archive somewhere of their diaries and thoughts and journals or like correspondences with other people in which they discuss these things. Yeah. Like, but we're not going to look into any of that. We're just going to assign motives to them because they're not here to defend themselves.
This guy strikes me as like he would be maddening to have as like some kind of therapist where it's like,
oh yeah,
where he might say something and it gels with you and you're like, oh, that actually really works with me, helping me mm-hmm. to like reorient my worldview or like kind of get a grip on my internal process and like
right
you know. And I can imagine like you're going to therapy, right, or you're following something and you're like 3 or 4 days into it, like over matters of weeks or whatever, and
yeah,
couple of sessions, and then you say something and he's like, no, it's not like that, it's like this,
right?
And you've worked out this internal framework that's going to work for you, and you're now mm-hmm. trying to talk about it, and he's like, no, shut the fuck up, that's not how it works, it's this way. This is the formula for happiness.
Right. Right. You're wrong. You got to do it this way.
You're wrong. Your internal experience is wrong.
It's wrong.
Fix it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. He says that. So like he lauds, you know, like he could have asked Bill Gates and Warren Buffett if they are motivated for like winning for winning's sake. Like you could just ask them. They are still alive.
Right.
You could get in touch with them and be like, hey, I'm a famous guy who takes no strings attached money from shadowy business entities and like does research that's completely unpeer reviewed and unsubstantiated.
Right.
And I would love to know if the reason that you have so much fucking ungodly money and control over farmland and all sorts of other things is because you enjoy winning for winning's sake.
Right.
I have a feeling, since I've read a bunch of shit that Warren Buffett has written, that Warren Buffett is not interested in winning for winning's sake. That just does not seem to me to be his motivation at this point. Like, I don't know, whatever. He says, in contrast to these donors, who he identifies as the aforementioned industrial capitalists, you know, that I just said, in contrast to these donors, there are quote unquote accumulators who believe that the person who dies with the most toys wins. So he's saying Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, and Charles Feeney, his personal patron.
Right.
Are not accumulators.
Paragons.
They're donors. They're paragons of virtue. Paragons of fucking virtue. Yeah. I read that and I almost threw the book across the room.
Maybe that's the title of this.
Like, well, Paragons of Virtue. I almost threw my book across the room.
Yeah.
Like, all I could think of while I was reading this portion is that book Anand Giridharadas wrote, Winners Take All, and it's all about the fucking fast one that billionaires pull on society when they trickle out just enough of the money that they've made towards liberal social causes to prevent people from chopping their heads off in the street with a guillotine.
Right. Right.
And the amount of money that they give back to these quote unquote philanthropic causes is nowhere near adequate to countervail the damage that they did accumulating that wealth in the first place.
Right. Like, it's just not even close.
So let's just point out here, for the sake of pointing out to anybody who might be listening to this, if you are a billionaire, it is a mutually exclusive condition to being a paragon of virtue. You cannot be virtuous if you are accumulating billions of dollars.
Right.
These things are not possible together. You can't be a good person and be a billionaire. Because in order to accumulate a ton of money, like billions of dollars, you are doing incredibly destructive things to people and the environment.
Yep.
And the animals, too. So he basically has told me that his basis for what he thinks is completely unjustifiable, and I should not trust anything that he says, and this is only page 19.
Right, yes.
Right, so... He says, there's another thing. It, just like Yuval Noah Harari, a lot of the things that undermine my ability to take these authors seriously have nothing to do with the actual thesis of their published work. It's the other weird things that they say that don't have to be included in these books at all. Like, you didn't have to say that at all, but now, like, that you did, like, it makes me seriously doubt you.
How scintillating would it be to have sex with another species?
Right. That's Harari, like, for all of you listeners. A
paraphrase quote from,
Sapiens. Yeah. The first part of the book, too, because we never got past that.
Yeah.
This is an anecdote. Some people love horses. So this is an anecdote from page 21 that, again, has nothing to do with his actual thesis or anything about happiness or flourishing, but it's so ridiculous that it just makes me question everything this man says. Right, here it is. There is an island near the Portuguese island of Madeira. Which island? What is it? You could name it. You name Madeira. Why don't you name the actual island you're talking about? There is an island near the Portuguese island of Madeira that is shaped like an enormous cylinder. The very top of the cylinder is a several acre plateau on which are grown the most prized grapes that go into Madeira wine. On this plateau lives only one large animal. Well, just one. There are no other animals up there. There's just one animal. Okay. It is an ox whose job is to plow the field. Right. I don't think oxes plow vineyards, right?
You don't plow a vineyard. You don't do a lot of, like, you do it one time. And then the vines stay for years and years and generations.
Right? You don't, like, till a vineyard. Anyway, okay, this doesn't make any sense already. An ox whose job it is to plow the field. There is only one way up to the top, a very winding and narrow path. How in the world does a new ox get up there when the old ox dies? A baby ox is carried on the back of a worker up the mountain where it spends the next 40 years plowing the field alone.
Correction. According to a website called the Burgundy Briefing, plowing, horse-drawn plowing is something that is done with the idea that it allows the roots to breathe.
Okay.
So animal-drawn plows could be a part of traditional winemaking. Just
okay.
So we're gonna
forgive that hypothetically.
Yeah.
So there might be an ox, right?
Yeah.
But my question is, like, if a human being can carry a baby ox on their back and still traverse up the path, then the ox could have walked its own ass up there. Am I wrong?
I mean, yeah, like, it's sort of
like, why do you need to carry the baby ox? Like, the implication here is that there's the only one way to top, very winding and narrow. But if you can fit the ox on your back and still traverse the path, then it's not too narrow for the ox. So why are you carrying it?
Right, right. Like, presumably the baby can walk. Like, it's sort of,
this stuff just doesn't make any fucking, you're like, what?
Well, my bigger issue with that passage is it seems to just come out of nowhere and have no meaning.
Yeah, okay, so he says, if you are moved by this story, ask yourself why. Is there someone in your life whom you would feel comfortable phoning at 4 a.m. to tell your troubles to? I'm sorry, what? I'm calling a friend now? What happened to the ox?
Yeah, like, it's just...
He never explains the ox story!
That was the part that just kind of, when you sent that passage, I was like, I don't understand, the transition makes no sense. Like,
yeah,
okay, fine, it's an interesting story. It's something that might make you think a little bit. You're like, okay, so the idea basically is, like, they bring an ox into a space that once it grows bigger, it can't leave.
I guess.
Like, at the end of the day, right? Like, that's kind of, that seems to be what's being implied. The idea
sure.
is what, the idea, I think, isn't so much that the ox is carried by a human, more that a baby ox is brought, but with the idea that it will live the rest of its life there because you can't bring it back off the island. It's too big now. Let's just, maybe, I don't know.
Sure,
but
sure,
like,
I grant.
You know, interesting, sure, okay.
What's your point, though?
Yeah, but why, though? Like,
what does this have to do with flourishing or happiness? He never says. He never explains
just,
why.
It's crazy making, because then he's like, if this story is interesting to you, think about if you would call a friend at 4 a.m. What?
Right. What? It just doesn't... more and more things in this book are like that, where it's like, these things don't connect. Like, I don't understand why you're saying half the shit you're saying, because it doesn't tie into anything else you're saying.
It's like, it doesn't, it's so fucking weird. I want to be like, Meg, I have this pen. It has 3 colors, black, blue, and red on the
Amazing.
Same pen. Amazing, right?
Yeah.
Therefore, how was your birthday?
Right.
Like, what?
What? Yes. They're like totally, like, non sequitur, like, ideas.
The thing is, like, conversationally fine. Like, absolutely fine. Like, you know what? Just pivot. Great. We're going to talk about something else. Let's talk about pooping and birds. Like, amazing.
Yeah.
But, like, it's just like, you're writing a book, man. Like, you're put forward some strong fucking theories here.
Right. Well, here's one. Here's a strong thing. Being social is the most successful form of higher adaptation known.
Uh-huh.
Citation?
Yeah, like, there's a lot. That's a big, bold claim.
Yeah.
It's the superlative of superlatives. It is a paragon of social, or of what? What did he call it?
The most successful form of higher adaptation known is being social.
Being social. So, I'm being social right now. I am a paragon of the highest form of adaptation.
Uh-huh.
Nailed it.
He says that, like, the whole reason that, so this is a very Harari moment, right?
Yep.
Seligman says that at some point in humans' evolution, we went from having a brain that is 600 cc's in volume to a brain that is currently 1200 cc's in volume. And the extra 600 cc's in volume that we accumulated or developed or evolved into over an indiscriminate period of time that he does not describe. Mm-hmm. He says the whole point of the 100% increase in brain volume is just to be able to have love, compassion, kindness, teamwork, and self-sacrifice. So he basically says, like, humans are built for social relationships, and that is why our brains are so big. But he also doesn't offer any explanation for why he thinks that or if anybody else agrees with him.
Right.
He says, we will never know if social insects have hive emotions and if arthropods have found and exploited non-emotional ways to sustain group cooperation.
Yeah, this guy writes, every sentence he writes just rubs me as someone who's like spent a lot of time reading science publications and trying to write scientific,
right.
You know, writing in a science, like it's that writing of like authoritative, like it's not, he could say, instead he could just say, we don't know.
Yeah.
Or I was unable to find any evidence currently under study about this thing. But he just says, we will never know.
Right. Yeah. We can't know. So don't question it. Just take what I say for granted.
Right.
He says here, like, well-being theory is plural in method as well as substance. Positive emotion is a subjective variable defined by what you think and feel. Engagement, meaning, relationships, and accomplishment have both subjective and objective components, since you can believe you have engagement, meaning, good relationships, and high accomplishment, and be wrong, even deluded. The upshot of this is that well-being cannot exist just in your own head. Well-being is a combination of feeling good as well as actually having meaning, good relationships, and accomplishment. This, the way we choose our course in life is to maximize all five of these elements. And I wrote, so people who are disabled and without any one of these are excluded from the possibility of well-being?
Yes. Sucks.
I mean,
to
that's
be
what
you.
He's saying.
Sorry.
Right?
I don't, yeah.
You
no,
can't,
I mean, it's fucking
only some people
nuts.
Can have flourishing, and it's only people who have those five elements with the sub elements in each of them.
Right.
If evolution had to rely on maximizing happiness, the human race would have died out long ago. This is the only sentence in this whole book so far that I agree with.
It's something that I've often kind of like, it's something I think about. It's like kind of fundamental to the human condition, right? It's like we're here. Our current understanding of evolution and how we came to exist suggests that our well-being and happiness is secondary to the one thing, which is propagation of the species, to like
right.
spread the fucking genes, right?
Right.
And so everything that we do as humans is on top of that. Like it's
yeah.
it's sort of
it's like
and we spend,
icing on the cake.
Yeah, and it's also like you can see it. It's hard. Like we live in such a modern society where like most of us have houses, or even if you're homeless, like you probably live in a very urban environment is my guess, or like relatively, like there are human structures, like the environment has been, the weather has been beat mm-hmm. back to a certain mm-hmm. extent. And
yes,
and again, if you're homeless, like and being homeless is part of this problem, right? Like it, or part of it, it's a good example of the issue, which is that, you know, fighting against the elements and survival and all of those things, like everything we've done is created an environment that we're more flourishing in, right?
As
a species.
Right.
Like, it's not, you know, we have other problems now. Like, we've got all these social issues and we've got all these other existential threats to individuals and all of that shit. But, like, anyway,
yeah.
Sorry.
I feel like he tries to quantify flourishing or qualify it with these five bullet points.
Yeah.
But I'm like, how do you even say that, like, one person is flourishing more or less than another? Or that our flourishing in the 21st century exceeds the flourishing in the 18th century?
Right.
Or that, you know what I mean? Like, there's no basis for comparison. Like, it seems preposterous to try and make these arguments. Like, he goes on where he says, so the sentence that I didn't disagree with, the first one in the whole book that I didn't disagree with, if evolution had to rely on maximizing happiness, yep. the human race would have died out long ago. He says, he goes on, so clearly, either humans are massively deluded about how much life satisfaction children will bring, or else we use some additional metric for choosing to reproduce. Okay, I'm going to debunk this one right here.
Yep.
You ready?
Yep.
Some people are massively deluded about how much joy children will bring to them because 100%. They admit this. They admit yes. regretting having children, right?
Oh, it's like so common. It's a cliche.
Yeah. Additionally, yeah. at least in America,
yeah.
one out of every two pregnancies is unplanned. So in other words, nobody's deluded about whether or not right. they're going to be happy with yes. kids. They're not even thinking about it.
Right. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes. Like,
and then he goes on. I found this particularly funny because of how we feel about certain things in our own lives. Similarly, if personal future happiness were our sole aim, we would leave our aging parents out on ice floes to die. Not only is this a bizarre and non sequitur thing to say, I'm like, where's the ice floe? Because right? yes. sign me up. Right.
Also, like, some cultures have done that. Like, what?
Yes.
Like, right? wait, what do
so
you mean?
Who are you talking about?
It's horrifying, of course, but it's not like you've made this sort of hyperbolic, like, suggestion with the idea that that would never happen. It's like, no, that fucking happened.
So what's your point?
Like, yeah. No, we are. We did do that. Humans have done yeah. that. Like, that's
yeah.
a thing. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, my whole problem with that is I don't live near an ice floe. Otherwise, I'd be first in line. You know? Like, super weird. He also talks in here about, increasing flourishing. Public policy follows only from what we measure, which is a weird claim. Like, I don't even know how to, address that claim. Public policy follows only from what we measure. I don't think that's true at all. And until recently, we measured only money, gross domestic product. So the success of government could be quantified only by how much it built wealth. But what is wealth for anyway? The goal of wealth, in my view, is not just to produce more wealth, but to engender flourishing. We can now ask of public policy, how much will building this new school rather than building this park increase flourishing? We can ask if a program of vaccination for measles will produce more flourishing than an equally expensive corneal transplant program. Like, he's comparing apples to oranges, which is really weird. And I was like, also, like, this sounds an awful lot like you're talking about Mill and Bentham and, like, utility. Like, maximizing the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest amount of people. But he doesn't say anything about that. He's just, like, right. ripping off major ideas from philosophical ethics without, like, crediting the people who discussed all of these ideas at extreme length. Like, a lot of writing was devoted to this. So he says at the very end of this chapter one, he says, so the goal of positive psychology in well-being theory is to measure and build human flourishing. And achieving this goal starts by asking, what really makes us happy? And I was like, oh, God. You know what I mean? Right. Like, oh, no. So here is, and this is probably the last thing that we have time for in this particular podcast. But yeah. this is the thing that, like, made me have to put the book down.
Yeah.
And walk away from it until I reopened it today to tell you about these things on this podcast. So he makes this grandiose statement with zero support whatsoever because he's really good at the zero support thing. Mm-hmm. Here's a brief exercise that will raise your well-being and lower your depression.
I'm in. I need that. Let's do it. I'm ready.
I do too. Ready? Here we go. Okay. Close your eyes. Call up the face of someone you still alive who years ago did something or said something that changed your life for the better. I don't even know if I have one of those people, period. Right? Someone who you never properly thanked. Oh, God, that's an even harder condition to meet. Right? Someone you could meet face to face next week. Okay, so you want me to think of someone who did something amazing for me years ago who I never thanked, but who I could also run into next week if I had to.
Right. Okay, got it.
I know nobody like this.
Done.
Maybe you
do. I already
do.
Know who it is. Yep.
He goes on to say, gratitude can make your life happier and more satisfying. When we feel gratitude, we benefit from the pleasant memory of a positive event in our life. Also, when we express our gratitude to others, we strengthen our relationship with them. But sometimes our thank you is said so casually or quickly that it is nearly meaningless. In this exercise called the gratitude visit, mm-hmm. you will have the opportunity to experience what it is like to express your gratitude in a thoughtful, purposeful manner. Your task is to write a letter of gratitude to this individual and deliver it in person. The letter should be concrete and about 300 words. I don't know why 300. He doesn't say. Be specific about what she did for you. He now genders the person that he is hypothetically. Okay, that's important in a minute, right?
Right.
She. The letter should be concrete, about 300 words, and be specific about what she did for you and how it affected your life. Let her know what you are doing now and mention how you often remember what she did. Make it sing! Exclamation point. Once you have written the testimonial, call the person and tell her you'd like to visit her, but be vague about the purpose of the meeting. Semicolon. This exercise is much more fun when it's a surprise. When you meet her, take her to your take your time reading your letter to her. Notice her reactions as well as yours. If she interrupts you as you read, say you really want her to listen until you're done. After you have read her letter, every word, discuss the content and your feelings for each other. You will be happier and less depressed 1 month from now.
It's so,
not 3 weeks.
It's so like this
not
is,
6 weeks.
This is the recipe for fucking rape culture, right? Like it's sort of like it's you know, I need to tell you how I feel about you.
Yep.
And you need to sit down and shut up and listen.
Yep.
And then you better be grateful because I'm gonna feel happy now. Because I've told you how I feel about you.
Right. And what? I'm going to need you to sit there quietly. And
listen. Don't interrupt me.
I love that he basically explicitly says, you need to violate this person's consent repeatedly in order for this to work. You need to not tell them the purpose of the visit. You need to definitely meet them face to face. So you need to be in their space at some point in time.
Right.
And if they tell you, if they try to interrupt you at all, you need to shush them.
And you need to show up with a huge amount of emotional baggage that you've written down in a 300 word letter that you're now going to read to them.
Right. And then you expect them to discuss the content and your feelings for each other.
Gross. So gross.
What?
So gross.
Serious question. If somebody called you up after 10 years and said, hey, I really need to come see you. And you were like, oh my gosh, wow. Haven't talked to you in a long time. Why do you need to come see me? And they were like, can't tell you. It's a surprise. Would you ever say yes?
No.
I'd be like, clearly you want to kill me. There's no way I'm saying yes to this. And then if for some fucking insane mental lapsed reason, momentary lapse of judgment, I was like, I guess I can meet up with you. And then they were like, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to read this and you can't interrupt me. And if it started to make me feel weird or uncomfortable or something, I was like, I'm going to have to stop you there. They'd be like, no, you need to be quiet and listen until I'm finished.
This is, I feel like this is cult-like behavior.
Extremely.
This, you know what though? If somebody actually calls me out of the blue and says that, I'm going to be like, did you read Flourish? Is that why is this a trap?
About Martin Seligman?
Is this about Martin Seligman?
Did you go to his website?
God. So this book was written in 2011. Did not age well.
No, did not.
I'm curious. Your professor assigned this book? The whole book?
Yeah, the whole ass book in a single week.
So
listen, here's the other thing, right?
Yeah.
Reading a 300-page book in a week is not a problem for me, and I don't think it's out of scope for somebody in a graduate program.
No.
Right? The volume is not the issue. The problem that I have is that we have to read this entire ludicrous, ridiculous book in a week, whereas the rest of the time, we've been reading a wide variety of disciplinary perspectives on a number of different... So the class I'm in is liberal arts approaches to emotion. And the degree that I'm seeking is an interdisciplinary degree where I approach the degree program. I say, here's a research question I'm very interested in looking at from an interdisciplinary perspective. Can you let me in the program to do that? And then they say, yeah, that sounds interesting. So my goal is to look at liminal spaces from a wide variety of disciplinary angles, anthropology, sociology, philosophy, medicine, whatever, right? Like all these different perspectives. What do these people think is important about this idea? What do they have to say about what it means? What is true? What is not true? All these things. How does that fit with other disciplinary perspectives? What do I have to add or say about this? Where do I think they're wrong? What are they missing? All this stuff, right? It's a big project. So it's weird to me because every other class, we've had like 4 or 5 or 6 readings about a particular subject within the realm of like human emotion and what all these different people have to say about. Like we've talked about grief, we've talked about like all different kinds of stuff, right? Yeah. And so like the thing that's weird this week is that we have to read one source. And it's not like an excerpt from it. It's like the whole source. And we don't have any, like there's nothing else going on this week. And I have to give on Monday, I have to give like an oral presentation about the 9th and 10th final chapters of this book. And I'm going to basically just reiterate what he said and not offer any of my own opinions because I have nothing positive about this book to say. And if I, like it is the complaints that I have about it are so in excess of what my assignment is to just recover chapters 9 and 10 that I don't even know, like I'm going to give my presentation and be like, here's what chapters 9 and 10 said. There you go. Summarized them. That's the deal. That's the gist of what he's trying to convey here. And if anybody asks about my personal opinion, I'm going to be like, I don't know where to start with this garbage.
Yes. Yeah.
Like I cannot tell you how little I value what he has to say in this book.
Right. Yeah. I think that's what I'm curious about, right? Because it's like, I think when I was, you know, when I've had professors assign reading material like this, I'm mm-hmm. always like, a lot of it has to do with like, okay, but how does the professor chose this for a reason. What was that reason? Like,
right.
If I just shit all over this, what trouble am I going to get into? Like, how am I going to make this more difficult for myself? There were a few, like, for sure, there were some things I've had in some classes where I just was like, I can't go past this point. Like, you're asserting something and it is just factually incorrect.
Yeah.
And there's just a mountain of evidence. Like, there was I can't remember what it was about, but, like, we took this, like, library science course. And I really liked it. And I really liked the teacher. But there was something she'd said that I was like, I don't think that's right. And it like kind of stuck with me. And then like, it mm-hmm. was an assignment and she was like, keep trying to teach this. Like, I don't remember what it was. It was like this term for like a certain kind of paper or something. And sure. I was like, this is not right. This is not right. And like, I kept kind of getting back to it. And finally, like at the end of the course, she'd given me like kind of a bad grade. And I was like, what's the deal? And she's like, well, you know, you never answer this right. I'm like, it's wrong. And I just kept bringing it. Like, I was like, there's a mountain of evidence in your own library about why this is wrong. And like, we just had a disagreement and like, we just never talked again. Oh, I was like, I don't know what to do. Like, I was like, it's just not right.
Yeah.
It's not, there's nobody who agrees with you. There's no, you know, whatever the fuck it was. I don't remember what it was, but it was some kind of, and the worst part, like, it was just some stupid thing. I was just like, I don't, but it was just like, I couldn't do it because she just kept fucking trying to hammer that home. And like every time in class, I was like, but it that's says over here, right, that's not though. True. Anyway.
God. Well, and the last little
and
anecdote.
I was an older student, right? So it was like younger students are just like, dude, just shut up and say what you want and get a grade and move out. And I was like,
right. Yeah.
Move on. I was like, I don't, this grade doesn't matter to
do
me.
Do the transaction.
Like, yeah. I was like, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I'm fucking doing it.
I feel you on this. As an ethicist, this book is incredibly inflammatory to me.
Yeah.
Because it flattens, reduces, and regurgitates without citation all of the major themes in ethics, but it gets them all wrong. And like, I'm pretty sure, and you alluded to this earlier, but then we're like, we'll get to that at the end.
Yeah.
On page 31, under the subheading of Can Well-Being Be Changed? He says, if positive psychology aims to build well-being on the planet, well-being must be buildable. And I'm like, I literally think that is a classic Wittgensteinian tautology, tautology. Like,
yes, it's like
it's a tautology in logic, in like rhetorical logic, is a statement that can't not be true.
The way it's worded is like we're doing this thing, therefore it must be possible to do the thing. Right?
If we're gonna build it, it has to be buildable.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're not saying anything there.
Right.
Like, I just read that and I was like, this is like a classic logical tautology. Long cat is long. Well, yes, but that doesn't mean anything. Like, you can't, so it's not. Yes. What? So like the truth value of the statement is really weird. I don't know. He also says here that he says that like a lot of trying to alleviate the root causes of human suffering is not like a durable solution to finding happiness. And he says the hope that better externalities could make people lastingly happier was discouraged by a study of lottery winners who were happier for a few months after their windfall, but soon fell back to their habitual level of grouchiness or cheerfulness. Did you know that winning the lottery is the single strongest indicator of whether someone will go bankrupt or not? He doesn't mention that here.
I did know that. Yeah. No, I like winning the lottery is like really detrimental to a lot of people.
Yes. Yes. And it's like he said, he just claimed, yeah, you know, externalities are not what makes happiness because lottery winners. Okay. Like, he just like, and basically like that he says here, writing about why the positive events in your life happened may seem awkward at first, but please stick with it for 1 week. It will get easier. The odds are that you will be less depressed, happier, and addicted to this exercise 6 months from now. He gives these like time frames. A month from now, if you ambush a stranger who you didn't thank appropriately, you'll be less depressed in a month. If you write down why positive events in your life happened, 6 months from now, you're going to be less depressed. Put a pin in that. It's measurable, objective.
It's like this is kind of what I think I was alluding to earlier, where it's like this guy would be insufferable as a psychologist or like as a therapist, because you might draw from this that having some general awareness of the things that are positive in your life can help you feel happier. If you can kind of like think more about the things that are good, that are going right, and spend less time ruminating on the shit that sucks.
Right.
Sure. Got it. Like, yeah, your mind is going to be in a state of like more happiness more of the time, and you're going to feel it, right? It's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
But like, or not. I don't know if that works for some people, I've heard. Right. Like, you know, give it a shot if you want. But this guy is like just fucking like insane about it.
His
like,
assertions.
It's like, his assertions are insane. His take on shit where it's like, it's very much, it's like the maddening shit with my dad, like while I'm in therapy right now, right? Like we're trying to recover a relationship so that we can have a relationship. And and like his take on shit is always like if I was like, hey, listen, please don't kick me in the shins anymore. And he'd be like, mm-hmm. okay, but what does that mean? And I'm like, okay, like, so yesterday when we were in therapy, you like walked up to me and kicked me in the shin and it really hurt. And he'd be like, okay, I got it. So the new rule is that when we're in therapy yesterday, don't kick you in the shin. Got it. I will never kick you in the shin yesterday again. I promise.
Right.
While we're in therapy. That therapist, right? Like,
yeah.
It's like, no, man, like, just don't kick me in the shin. Okay, got it. I won't kick you in the shin. And then next week he's like punching me in the arm.
Right.
And it's like, okay, don't punch me in the arm. He's like, okay, God, how many rules are there?
I know, right?
And this guy is like the weird prescriptiveness of it and the detail, but then like the lack of detail and support for shit at the same time. Like, you know, definitely think of somebody you'd like to creep on. And then think about them hard and write 300 words about how creepy you want to be towards them.
Yep.
Then call them and tell them that you'd like to meet with them, but don't tell them why.
Right.
And then hold them hostage while you read this creepy shit to them.
Right. What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
This is about your happiness.
Right.
Just
not
go
theirs.
Get it.
It's yours.
Right. Right.
God. There's also like a lot of the shit that's going on, like all the writing and stuff reminds me. Have you ever seen, there's a YouTube sketch called The Expert and it's about Seven Red Lines.
Oh, God, no, I haven't seen it.
All right. So some of our listeners will hopefully have seen it. But if you haven't, if you go on YouTube and you look up a sketch called The Expert, and it should be Seven Red Lines, a.k.a. The Expert. If you Google it, you'll find it.
Okay.
And this is a consultation meeting where like a client is approaching like a software firm or something, or like a like an engineering firm where they're going to produce this product, and mm-hmm. they're having a meeting about it, the initial meeting, and there's an expert who's an expert at drawing red lines. And the way that there's like a meeting, there's like a project manager, there's a vendor lead, there's like all these people, and then the expert, like the one who's okay. actually going to do the thing. And and so they're having this meeting discussing the seven red lines. And as the requirements come out for them, it gets more and more absurd. And the expert keeps trying to say, well, that's not possible. Like at one point, they're like, they want one of the lines to be drawn in green. And he's like, okay, but then it won't be a red line. And like, no, we need seven red lines. And like at one point, it's like all the lines need to be parallel, but one of them needs to be perpendicular. And he's like trying to explain to them how none of the, like, the more it goes on, the more impossible it gets. And then, but everybody weighs in except for the expert on how, uh-huh. well, of course, no, we'll figure it out. It'll be fine. Like, it's doable. And yeah. this is where, like, it, this book reminds me of it, because it's like he's writing this absurd shit and like contradicting himself like every fucking three paragraphs or whatever, and like throwing random shit in there, like, oh, hey, by the way, there's this island where these people used to get with an ox. Well, a baby ox, but then it's a big ox and it plows the fields. And the human carries the baby ox up there.
Right.
Like, doesn't that stir or something? Like, it's just really, it's like,
ask yourself why.
Yeah, just why? Like, doesn't it make you think? It's it has this like absurdity to it that just makes me laugh so hard. Because right. you sent me a photo of the page, so I'd read it myself, and it was like, it's right. just fucking in there. It's not right. even like, it's not like, okay, I'm going to tell you this story, and the reason I'm going to tell you this story is because this. It's an illustration.
It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. Idiom. It's yeah, a whatever. Idiom. Yeah. Right.
No, no. No. It's just like, hey, here's a random paragraph story, pretty short. And then right at the end there, I'm going to just say, anyway, does that stir anything in you? Okay, by the way, if you were able to call somebody, if you have a friend you can call at 4 a.m, you're going to live longer, just so you know. Right. FYI. Moving on. So,
I was like, is the friend at 4 a.m. the person carrying the baby ox? Like, I'm sorry. Like, where is the... I don't see how this, like, matches actually, up to anything.
This segues towards the end really well for me, which is, if you know, you should yes, write in.
I forgot to say. Tell us.
So I'm Ned, and this is Meg, and this is our podcast, Feature Creep, colon, built-in microwave. And we would love to hear from you. And you can email us. You can email Dana, D-A-N-A, at fcbm.io. And she is the CEO and founder of this podcast. And if you email her directly, it will annoy our CEO, but then she'll send it to us, which is the whole
yeah.
point. I don't think it'll annoy her. She loves to hear from us, from people. Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway,
yes.
but yeah, write in and let us know your thoughts on this mm-hmm. book. And if you read it and it helped you, that's fantastic. Like,
right.
I'm
great.
You know, not just because we think fucking all we have is vitriol to say about this author. Doesn't mean that you can't have happiness from it. Like, that's not the point.
Right.
Yeah.
No, like, in fact, whether or not his book causes you to be capable of greater happiness is, like, for me, entirely beside the point.
Yes, yes, exactly. Like, that's, yeah, it's just...
I guess I would say this. If yeah. after reading this book, you implement any of the exercises that he suggests, and basically what I'm getting now is that the gist of his book, in a grand sort of sense, is that if you follow his advice and do his exercises, you will be happier than if you take any of the drugs that your psychiatrist prescribed for you, happier than if you do talk therapy. Like his book and his advice, his little bullet pointed list and his little exercises will be more successful at increasing flourishing in your life than any other possible method so far discovered or developed. Right.
Right.
Like, he has figured it out to the exclusion of all other methodologies. He is very clear about this in segments of the book that I didn't even get to. He's like, here's the deal. Everything else was wrong. This is right. There is no crossover appeal. There is no overlap. There is no, like, the next chapter that I have to start reading that I'm going to loathe already, and I can tell you that I'm going to hate it, is about, it's called The Dirty Little Secret of Drugs and Therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So basically, he's going to be like, those drugs are bullshit. What you really need is some fucking gratitude. Which to me is like the most neoliberal, paternalistic fucking horseshit. Like, and he says, don't pay attention to any of the externalities that might be making your life hard and giving you anxiety and therefore depression. What you really just need to focus on is the important happy shit. Right? Like, right. And a friend of mine actually had a therapist recently who refused to acknowledge that the fact that he lives off of $15,000 a year in income could at all impact his mental health.
Wait. Okay. Wait.
So he is very, very poor, right?
Yes.
Earns from doing work. He earns about $15,000 a
year. This is a friend of yours.
This is a friend of mine.
Okay, gotcha.
He's a very poor person.
And he refuses to acknowledge that may have an impact.
Yeah. Yes, his therapist was like, your money situation has nothing to do with your mental health. This is all about your orientation to, like, happiness and how you're thinking about the problem. Like, this therapist refused to accept or acknowledge or entertain the possibility that maybe a root cause of his anxiety was the fact that he lives with crushing poverty and there's very little that he can do to be upwardly mobile for circumstantial reasons that pertain to his life, right? Him as an individual.
Right.
He the work that he does is very underpaid and he's self-employed and there's not a lot he can do about that. I mean, you can always make the argument like go back to school or whatever, but like these things are sort of like practically impossible. So this therapist was like, your money situation has nothing to do with your anxiety. This is about you being like an undisciplined thinker and shit. Which is basically the same argument that Martin Seligman is making here.
I feel like there's a way to do this, which is like, you're, you know, like on the balance, this is a life that you want to keep living and, or you want to keep going in this direction and you're looking for coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sure, fine. Like, you know, you're not able to fix the financial situation, which is mm-hmm. absolutely a valid thing. Like,
right.
You know, like it's hard and not always possible. Despite what people say. And it has nothing to do with whether you're a good worker or whatever. Like it's, or whether you work hard or whatever. Like those things help, but they're not anyway.
Right.
Like you could say, hey, you're in a bad way. This is a hard situation. And, you know, there isn't a solution where you can get paid more for what you're doing and you want to do this. You mm-hmm. want to find ways to like, cope with this, like, okay, yeah. I guess you know, find a way to be happy with what you have is certainly a worthy goal, but like the idea of just saying like, well, this has nothing to do with the fact that you're just fucking abject poverty going on,
right?
That's nonsense. Of course right. it does. Of course right. it does. Of course you would be happier if you didn't have to worry about tomorrow.
Of course you'd be happier if you had money for, I don't know, food.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so one of the critiques of this book is that it's like extremely neoliberal in its scope, which is to say that it places all of the blame for you not being happy on you not thinking hard enough gratefully.
Yeah, that's fucked up. That's reality distortion.
Like, right.
we're all constantly suffering from externalities and like fucking, you know,
right.
existential dread and all the fucking shit that's going on.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, and he talks about like it's really important for you to have like really well-developed and positive relationships with your family and an extended network of people. And it's like, okay, well, what about if your family is super abusive like our families? Like,
right?
Okay, I guess you just don't deserve flourishing then.
Like, you know, sure, let's focus on things you might be able to do today to help you feel better. Do you have a supportive family? Can you lean on them? Do right. you have friends? Like, but again, like that's also weird logic where it's like, okay, the external things don't matter, but also the external things are the things thing
matter.
That you need to use to
right.
matter.
Right.
Like the good right. ones, Just have good ones. Just have good friends, and then you're fine.
And then you're fine. Just be the type of person who has a good family and you don't have anything to worry about. Just be grateful.
Fucking easy. Jesus.
Right? So anyway, don't read this fucking book because it's a piece of garbage and waste of time, and it's going to be minutes and hours of your life you'll never get back again.
Right?
And it's not worth it.
It's not worth it.
And also don't read Sapiens.
Yeah. Also don't read Sapiens. That one's an easy one.
So yeah, that's it. That's all I have for now, because that's as far into this dipshitty book as I've managed to slog. I have honestly thought, like, yeah, because all I have to present on is chapters 9 and 10, I've thought about skipping chapters 4 through 8 and just going straight to the end and then just writing up the summary and being like, that's it, I'm done. You know, because I just can't fucking take it.
Right? Right?
And I don't even know, like, part of me is like, okay, if you're going to do the work, you should just be like, I reject this book on ethical grounds.
Yeah.
But I don't even think I have the energy to get into it.
It's hard to, like, yeah.
Like, I don't even know if I have it in me to launch an ethical critique of this text.
I think that you could probably... I think some of it's going to happen when you write it, like when you write your summary.
Yeah.
And so just when you edit your summary to not have that stuff, just keep that in a separate document.
And then good idea.
Because then if, like, I think it's reasonable to imagine that there might be some discussion, and at some point you may be put on the spot and you may be forced a little bit. I mean, not forced. You can obviously choose to just be like, I don't know, I don't want to talk about it. But yeah. At least you have those thoughts. Like, you're already going to think them. It's going to fucking come up. Like, there's no world in which you're writing this that you don't think and write down a lot of fucking criticism as you're writing just about two fucking chapters. Like,
right.
So anyway, so my argument is just that, you know, maybe just let it out a little bit and then, and then edit it down, but keep that draft so that, you know, if it comes up and push comes to shove, or it sounds like it might actually be welcome, then you could throw that out there in the discussion.
I mean, I have definitely been very critical on ethical grounds of some other things that we've read.
Yeah.
And our professors are like totally open to that. They're not like, well, you have to believe what this man says because we like him.
Right. Right.
You know, they're like there was another thing that we watched that was like a public service ad about, I don't even remember what. But I was like, this is extremely emotionally manipulative. Like, these people are presenting this ad as a sort of like discourager from the activities therein, and they want the whole thing is designed to make you feel so bad that you don't do the thing,
right?
Like, it was either like drugs or alcohol related. It was some kind of public service thing. But I was just like, this is like super emotionally manipulative. Like, they want you to feel so bad that you don't do the thing. But like, none of the people in this video are real people who had any consequences. These are just actors. So like, they designed this whole thing to make you feel shitty. And I just don't think that's ethical. And I don't think it's effective. Anyway, they were like totally open to my critique.
So according to Wikipedia, like, there's some fucking weird and unethical shit he did from the very beginning. Like,
oh, do tell me.
There's a section called Learned Helplessness in the Martin Seligman Wikipedia article. Mm-hmm. And it talks about Seligman and his colleagues accidentally discovered that the experimental conditioning they used with dogs led to behaviors which were unexpected, in that under experimental conditions, the recently conditioned dogs did not respond to opportunities to learn to escape from an unpleasant situation, aka electric shocks of moderate intensity.
Oh my god.
And there is a fictionalized account of the experiment and illustrations of anti-vivisection arguments about the ethics of electrocuting dogs in the name of psychology research clinical psychologist Guy Holmes' novel The Black Dogs of Glasslyn. That sounds like an interesting book to read.
It sure does.
Yeah. Anyway,
this guy kind of reminds me of. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, the way he writes, Like immediately makes me think he's someone who absolutely electrocutes somebody or something.
Yes.
If that's going to lead to, you know, let's see.
He reminds me of Neuralink.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much like just charge ahead, fucking unethical shit going on.
Yeah, right. like the things that you are doing as an organization would not fly in a normal academic setting, in a research setting with guardrails. So you just don't do it in the academic setting and with guardrails. You just do it secretly outside of academia. You privately fund it so you don't have to like go through an IRB, which is an internal review board, and you basically, or institutional review board, and you just circumvent the normal processes that would preclude you from doing the crazy shit you're doing, and then you only trickle out information and you don't share any of your actual results with anybody so they can't critique you.
Right. Exactly.
Like, that's exactly what he's done.
Checkmate. Sorry.
Checkmate, you liberal cuck.
God, I love that so much. It's so dumb. It's just like the weirdest fucking insult.
God. Anyway, that was that's my rant. End rant over.
All right. Okay. Well, we need to quit this and publish it. So
yeah, we're gonna do that.
I think we're gonna do it. I think we're just out of time. I don't think we have any closing section for this one.
No.
No treat at the end. Well, the treat at the end is: do we actually have a secret to life? I think the one we usually say, which is just don't be a dick.
Just don't be a dick.
Like there's some happiness to be had in that. So,
yeah.
Okay, that's all I got. Okay, thank you. Okay,
bye. Okay.